will open a public hearing on House Bill 2894. And Kara, would you tell us a bit about that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2894 reduces the amount of surety bond required for trustees of certain intergovernmental trusts, which I trust the people in front of us will explain much better than I could.
All right, thanks. And with that said, we will welcome Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will be very brief. Mr. Armstrong is the one who has the expertise on this. I'm happy to have introduced House Bill 2894 at the request of my hometown. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. This will facilitate the use of what has become a very popular tool in both public and private employment, but certainly so in cities and counties, deferred compensation plans. And those plans require surety provisions to maintain the fidelity of the funds. There is currently a 100% surety requirement, and as more and more employees contribute to deferred compensation accounts, it's becoming more and more difficult to maintain. And it's going to eventually impact the availability of deferred compensation accounts for public employees. This bill would reduce that suretyship requirement to 10%, which, as I understand, is consistent with federal requirements for suretyship for these same types of trusts. So it aligns us with federal law. It's adequate, and it will ensure that these types of accounts remain viable for our public employees statewide. So I commend it to you. As far as I know, there's nobody opposed to this. It should be a good bill for you to get out.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Shetterly. Members of the committee, I'm Ken Armstrong. I represent the ICMA Retirement Corporation. That's the International City Management Association Retirement Corporation, which is an organization managing $11 billion in assets nationwide and $65 million worth of assets here in the state of Oregon. Let me give you a little bit of perspective on this, and I've also brought with me two city managers, and also there's a representative of the Police Chiefs Association, Kevin Campbell, behind me. As Representative Shetterly has testified, we're aware of no opposition to the bill. In 1977, legislation was passed allowing local governments to establish deferred compensation plans with employees on which taxation is deferred for up to $7,500 of compensation annually. And there's an anomaly in Oregon law that requires fidelity bonding or surety bonds against misappropriation of 100% of the program's assets. This is an unusually punitive provision that's inconsistent with federal or state standards, and it limits fidelity bonding to no less than 10%, those are the standards that is I'm describing, or they impose a dollar cap. We're proposing House Bill 2894 to align Oregon law with respect to these intergovernmental commingled trusts with industry and federal standards. If this legislation is not approved, as Representative Shetterly has already testified, ICMARC will soon no longer be able to serve its customers because it will no longer be able to secure a bond, and it's going to have to discontinue its program in Oregon. I'll have you know that the ICMA Retirement Corporation currently serves over 100 cities, special districts, and counties in the state of Oregon. It's serving thousands of employees. This is basically, in our view, a fairness issue and just an effort to keep a very valuable and popular program functioning here into the future, which we're afraid it may not be able to do without this legislative fix.
Thank you. Any questions? I would ask just one brief question. Do you have any idea of the reason why the previous law requiring the 100% coverage, 100% bonding?
Mr. Chair, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure about that. It wasn't until the legislation was changed in the last couple of years that that was discovered, that it was going to need to maintain that 100% bonding requirement. So from whence it came, I can't specifically answer that.
All right. Thank you.
Any further questions?
All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2894, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2894.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2894 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2894 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, measure is passed, and Representative Shetterly will carry that. We will close the work session on House Bill 2894. Where should we go here? There we go.
Are you ready?
Okay. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2766. Give the committee a moment to...
There are hand and gross proposed amendments.
All right.
Coming.
Hand and gross proposed amendments coming. All right, Mr. Mulvihill, will you come forward, please? Okay, welcome. Mr. Mulvihill, if you would take your crack at explaining the amendments here on House Bill 2766, please.
Okay. Dennis Mulvihill, Washington County. First of all, I should say that the counties and the county fair boards are in agreement on this.
They are in agreement?
On this, right.
Okay.
What we have essentially is a bill that will do two things. One is it allows county commissioners, county commissions, county courts to remove fair board members for cause. And the second thing it does, because we're taking out sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the second thing it does is it provides for, and if you look at the dash 2 proposed amendments, that a county court may conclude that an agreement is needed to protect the county court from liability, and if they decide that that's necessary, then they can, this requires that they, not requires, says they can sit down with the county fair board to work out some terms and conditions on that. However, if there is an agreement already in existence, or they conclude that it isn't necessary, then they don't have to do it. And that is the extent of the, what the HB 2766 would do.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Foltz, if you would...
Just for the record, Gordon Foltz, Association of Oregon Counties. I would basically, the amended amendments accomplish what Dennis just outlined, and we are in concurrence with those.
All right. Thank you. Mr. McCulley.
Mr. Chair, John McCulley, Oregon Fairs Association, just to join the party here. We have agreed to what is being proposed here. We think they address the issues brought by the counties in the original hearing and yet meet the requirements we think that we have to make sure that the fairs that already have agreements can continue with those agreements.
Thank you. Representative Atkinson.
One quick question. When you say the fairs plural, do you include Jackson, Josephine County Fairs in that plurality?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, yes. The Oregon Fairs Association, which is the representative of all the fairs, does conclude this. And we will make sure that all of those fairs understand that they have agreed to this.
Thank you. I like that. That reminds me of home when I was a kid. Yes, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you gentlemen look at the Henning Gross dash 2s and tell me what your goal is for line 6 and 7?
Line 6 and 7 is being taken, removed. If you're looking at the amended version.
Right.
And we're taking that out because if you did that, you get it. What that language would do if you left it in there would say that if you have an agreement that you decide you don't want to have a fair board anymore, then the agreement would override that. I mean, that's sort of the extreme, but we don't want to go there.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, are you willing to accept the a motion?
Yes. Oh, and yes, I will, Representative. Let me ask one question just in clarification first. On line 12 of your dash 2 amendments here, is that a comma after...
That's a period.
A period after matters, contractual matters, period. Okay. All right. We shall do that. All right.
Star.
Representative Sack.
Actually, I just have more of a comment, if you might, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to say thanks to the fairs and the counties for getting together on this, and it makes it a lot easier for us to move legislation when that takes place.
Yeah, I'd certainly like to agree with that. I appreciate your effort. I know that you've been working on this for quite some time, all of you, and I appreciate your attitude of working together. Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 Hannon Gross amendments to House Bill 2766.
Representative Bowman moves the Hannon Gross dash 2 amendments in the House Bill 2766. Is there any discussion? All right. Any objections? All right. Seeing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2766 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2766 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? All right. Motion carries, and Representative Montgomery will be the bill carrier. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2766. Yes.
Yeah.
Committee, thank you for the speed here today. Appreciate it. The good weather may have something to do. All right, we will open a work session on House Bill. Pardon me, let's make that a public hearing on House Bill 2883.
Yeah.
And we will call Mr. Chandler up. And welcome, Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association. Here on House Bill 2883, with me today is Mr. Jerry Reeves, who is a builder from Portland. He has some exhibits he's handing in that will help elucidate the problem that we're trying to deal with this bill, as will the chart over here on the easel. Many local governments have restrictions in their land development code regarding the amount of a site that can be covered by the building footprint. There we go. We'll
can everybody see that okay? Representative Bowman, you're okay with that?
I'm fine.
Okay. Representative Starr, you can see this okay?
I see it.
Okay.
On that, the brown area would represent the footprint of the building, the wood shaded, the decks, the green, the yard, so on. In some, like I say, in many jurisdictions, they'll restrict by their code the percentage of the lot that the building can cover. And in many cases, that doesn't make much of a difference. But as lots get smaller, the amount that's actually going to be able to get built upon correspondingly gets smaller. In the packet that Mr. Reeves has handed out is a little chart that looks like this. Single-level homes, buildable area, and living area. The living area is basically the minus the garage, outbuildings, that sort of thing. And to give you some example, an idea, in the city of Lake Oswego, Lake Oswego has a 25% requirement. In other words, the building cannot occupy more than 25% of the site. So on a 7,000 square foot lot in Lake Oswego, if you do the single story, it can only be 950 square feet. That's living area. That's a relatively small house in today's marketplace. Essentially, to get a house large enough to fit the market, particularly in a jurisdiction like Lake Oswego, you have to go two stories. And again, in many cases, that isn't a problem. But for a lot of folks, including us aging boomers, two-story construction is not necessarily what the market demands. People with disabilities and that have difficulty getting around, older folks, one-story construction is far preferable to two-story because they have difficulty getting up and down stairs and so forth. And with the lot restrictions that jurisdictions impose, we are forced into building two stories. And what 2883 is attempting to do is to address that by prohibiting local government from setting those kinds of restrictions on certain lots. There's some Dash 1 amendments that should have been circulated, which do a couple of things. One is they change the number from 7,000 to 12,000 square feet on the lot size. The other, they make it clear that we are exempting out the area not already set aside by setbacks in local government. We're not attempting to do away with setback requirements. But what we are trying to do is to get to the issue of requiring double-story construction in a marketplace where the population is aging and single-story construction is going to be more and more preferred by people.
Thank you. Could you answer for me and go back and rehash in a moment the 7,000 feet, the 12,000 feet, what this is all about again?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to do that. On this chart, the single, if you look down here, it has a single-level home living area. That's the basically, that's the amount, that's the house, that's not the garage, that's not the deck, that's the living area of the home. If you have a lot restriction of 25%, if you have a 7,000 square foot lot, but you can only cover 25% of it, then the living area that you're able to build is 950 square feet on that 7,000 square foot lot. If you want an 1,800 square foot home, you go two stories. In order to get to an 1,800 square foot home, you'd have to expand that up between 35 and 40%, which in a number of jurisdictions would not be legal. And yet, you then would have an average-sized home on basically the average-sized lot in the Portland metropolitan area. I think the average-sized lot right now is about 6,700 square feet. So on a 7,000-square-foot lot, if you have a restriction on how much you can cover, you're in most cases forced into a two-story construction pattern.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chandler.
Representative.
My question is, could you explain the 25, 30, 35, and 40 percentage columns that you have? Is that different laws in different areas, or why this breakout this way?
Yeah, I'll let Mr. Reeves answer that question.
Hi, I'm Jerry Reeves, J.C. Reeves Corporation, 4850 Southwest Shoalsbury Road in Portland, Oregon. The difference is jurisdiction to jurisdiction range anywhere from the most restrictive 25% to probably the most normal 35% to none at all. So like Washington County, City of Sherwood, where we're familiar with and we build, there is no lot coverage issue. This wouldn't be an issue. But you can jump in the same county to the next city and all of a sudden there's a 35%, or some of them there's a 25%.
I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
And why do they have those restrictions in place?
We don't think they know. None of them know. And to illustrate, this is where we have. This is the lot, the overall size of the lot. The red indicates the setback requirements, 20 for, in most cases, it's 20, 20, and 5, and 5. And the rest of this should be building zone. So the green represents area that a house could theoretically be over, but because of the lot coverage percentage, you can't build it. So it forces you, because you're up to your lot percentage, this house is at scale here. This is at a 33% lot coverage. It's a two-story house.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair. I would think, and I don't know anything about why these restrictions are in place, but I would think because they didn't want big mansions sitting in the middle of a city on a lot. I that would be my assumption.
Well, I was just going to illustrate here a particular project, and we built this project. This project is in Lake Oswego. These homes here, all these homes that were planned, are all about 4,000 square foot houses, so they're big homes.
Mm-hmm.
But they all represent their square footage, they're all at pretty much the maximum lot coverage that you could be in Lake Oswego. Now, we had lots of customers coming to us wanting one-level houses.
Mm-hmm.
We could not build one-level houses in this project, even though we had lots of 10,000 square feet. We could not build one-level houses. These pictures right here illustrate, all we've done is taken a certain size two-story house, and we put the same size one-story house on each one of these, just to illustrate that from the view of the street, you can't tell any difference in the size of that home. The only way you're going to know the difference is from an airplane.
If that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, I mean, obviously, or at least it seems like there would be a cause and effect relationship here. If you can have a bigger footprint, you can keep more one-story homes and keep from the view blockage of having a number of two-story homes. Hasn't there been a large outcry about this issue?
And, Mr. Chairman, the blockage of views is a real issue in a lot of communities, and that you're absolutely right. If you can do single-story construction, you keep a lower profile. Anytime you have a hilly topography, the folks up the hill want to be able to look down the hill, and if you're doing two-story construction, unless the slope is fairly extreme, you're always going to be blocking that view somehow. And there have been a whole number of very interesting litigations filed over that. I would like to, if I may, respond a little bit to Representative Bowman's question about the intent. What jurisdictions typically use, and as Mr. Reeves mentioned, not every jurisdiction uses lot coverage restrictions. They attempt to get at this issue through setbacks by saying in order to have a not big, huge house and a little lot, you have to have a front yard of 20 feet and a backyard of 20 feet and so forth. And from our standpoint, that's the appropriate way to do it because that allows, once the jurisdiction has decided what they want their general streetscape to look like in terms of the building orientation, then if the rest of that property is open for construction, that leaves us free to suit for marketplace, whether it's an older buyer or a young person, whether they want to do two-story or a turret or whatever. But once you start doing the lot coverages, then you basically take away a significant number of options from people.
This project right here is a good example of what John's talking about. Here was our overall property that we purchased.
Mm-hmm.
20% of it went into open space as just an open space requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So the lots got smaller because of the open space.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were also some natural trees that were in here.
Mm-hmm.
So through the process, they determined that they didn't want the buffer, they didn't want the setback for the rear yard, they didn't want us to be in the street. So they created, even though these were on the lot, this was a no non-disturbance area. So then they started the setback from this line, so they gave us the 25-foot setback from here for our homes. So really, theoretically now, we've got this envelope here that everybody has said is okay to build in. And we've even got a movement to reduce setback requirements. But even if they reduce the setback requirements and let you bring the house closer to the street, you would increase this green more. But because of this arbitrary lot coverage issue that kind of comes in on us, that nobody knows why it's there, it stops you from having a bigger home. And so essentially it discriminates from being able to build level homes.
If I could ask one more question,
Mr.
Chair. You know, I moved here from California where there are no lot size restrictions of any kind. And when you saw new developments go up, the homes would be enormous and they'd be right next door to each other. So you're basically looking in the kitchen or bedroom of the people who are next to you. And my concern is that with no restriction, we're going to end up with those kind of monstrosities being built all around in different parts of the state. And so how do we prevent those kind of monstrosities from being built? Because once they're built, you can't say, oh, it really doesn't look that good, so let's start over.
They don't shrink very well.
No, they don't.
You're right. Well, we're trying to get at that, Mr. Chairman, through the allowing setbacks. The jurisdiction can use side yard, front yard setbacks in order to get to the separation of units. One thing I want to mention, and this is one of the reasons we're bringing this bill forward is that the marketplace in Oregon is changing, as it is across the country. Row houses, townhomes, are a much more significant portion of our building environment than they ever have been. And a number of us were quite puzzled by that. We didn't think they would be. And what we found out, I did the research, but others who have found that what's happening is as the population ages, the boomers are getting older and the kids have left home, the dog's dead, they don't need the big house, the big yard, so they go move in a townhome. But the next step beyond that in terms of the marketplace is that their knees start to creak and they don't want to go up and down the stairs, and they're going to want to have the single-story construction. And it's an absolute fact that, you know, the rabbit is going to the python demographically, and the big lump of people that have been causing the ruckus all along are now going to cause a ruckus in when they're 50, because they're going to demand different things, different types of housing, different types of health care, different types of everything. We're simply trying to bring this bill forward to allow us to respond to that when we're faced with restrictions that make it impossible.
Let me ask you, why did you go from 7 to 12,000?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reeves, you want to handle that one, or do you want me to?
Well, it's simply because the a lot of the lots, even still up to the 12,000 square foot, won't get the average home that you say. If you have a community that's building all, and they have a need for $400,000 homes, they want to buy a $400,000 home in your neighborhood, but they need a one level to do it. We've got a lot of our property that are the larger lots, and it still doesn't get you much more than about 2,700-2,800 square foot. So it gets you a nice size rambler, but it's not a monstrosity.
What about the setback requirements? What can municipalities require as far as setback requirements? Is there any uniformity to that?
No, setback requirements require whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing isn't changing the setback requirements.
I realize that. I'm just wondering, will, in response to this legislation, if it would pass, would you find municipalities reacting to this by increasing setback requirements?
No, I don't believe so, because you've got all this extra area here, that this green area here, that theoretically we can build in without including the setback requirements.
Mm-hmm.
All the green is other area that theoretically is buildable area, but because of the lot covers, you can't do it. So if somebody wanted some bigger bedrooms right in here and they wanted to move this wall over,
mm-hmm.
and just fill that area in with the house, they can't do it.
Can't do it. Representative Starr, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this bill affect Metro?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, not directly, because Metro per se does not set building standards. It might affect some jurisdictions within Metro, but local cities and counties who have an urban development, have urban land within them, set the building standards, not Metro.
I've got a couple of questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Coming from local government, it seems to me that we would sit around a table and work session, and we'd have a report that we have to change our code, we have to get our building requirements, and I'd say, well, why do we have to do this? And I said, well, because Metro's 2040 plan says that we got to have this many people in here, and the only way we're going to do it is if we shrink lots and allow for more multifamily, more duplex building. Is that play into this at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, it perhaps would tangentially, but not too directly. For the most part, in the Metro plan, other than shrinking lot sizes, they haven't fiddled with single-family construction. I didn't say they won't when they get time on their hands, but they haven't up to this point.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you. And then I've got a couple of questions about local government and local government decisions. It seems to me that these are decisions that local governments make. Do you know how many jurisdictions have this kind of regulation on the books?
Not exactly. We know that a lot of them have them. The majority of them have them on the books.
Beaverton, Hillsboro, Tiger, Fulton.
Well, right. Those all do.
All of them do.
All those have them. The only ones that I know of for sure that don't are Washington County, City of Sherwood.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Do we have folks from LLC scheduled to testify on this bill?
No, we have no one.
We do now.
Apparently, we do now.
I'd like to have that point of view. Are these requirements appealable?
No.
No. You can't go in for a variance. You can't.
Oh. Mr. Chairman, you could ask for a variance, theoretically. I'm not aware of anybody that's ever done one successfully.
Well, we've been told no. We've had several instances where people have wanted to build a home, even in the two-story configuration, and be over the lot coverage issue just by a percent. And the planning department, we had to chop bays off and do little things because they said they had no authority to or way to get to building over within the over the set lot coverage issue.
If I can just continue just a little bit further here, you mentioned that these nobody knows why these things are on the books. Is that true? Nobody.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I think it's probably more. Appropriate answer is that we don't know what the reason rationale is. Mr. Bell is going to testify, perhaps.
Have you ever asked one of the local city councilor or your planning commissioners why these are in the books? Why these are?
I've asked many planning people why, and they don't seem to. You know, probably the most common reason that somebody would say was, well, we have to regulate the amount of. What do you call it? Non-pervious surface area. But that doesn't seem to hold water to me because as the densities are increasing and everyone's looking for higher and higher densities, then, you know, I don't know that makes any sense.
Just one last one, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this chance. It seems to me that if we got local governments passing land use or building requirements, and they don't know why, that those things could be repealed at those levels pretty simply, and that if it was an issue, then the local decision makers would have that ability to deal with it at a local level. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, we haven't had a whole lot of success in that effort, but you're right. These are set locally.
Have you? I'm sorry, I said one more, but this would be the last one. Have you used this as a campaign? Have we had folks run for city council saying these kinds of regulations? Or as a city councilor, I never had a developer or somebody come to me and say, you know, we got this on the books in Hillsborough, and we think this is a bad idea. You know, please change it.
Mr. Chairman, as a start, I think there might be several reasons for that. One, I believe Hillsborough's lot coverage restriction is fairly, it's about 35 or 40%, I believe. And secondly, we've only seen this problem get exacerbated here recently as lot sizes have shrunk. If you have a 45% or 30% requirement on a 15,000 square foot lot, you don't notice it. But when you have that same restriction on a 5,000 square foot lot, then you notice it, and then it makes it much more difficult. So I think that would be my guess as to why you haven't had. I mean, this is an issue that I was aware of. I've been doing this for a long time until the last couple of years when we started seeing the lot sizes come down, and we ran into that building envelope, and that was where the difficulty started to be much more apparent.
The other thing is that builders tend to do whatever is outright legal at the time. So if they're doing speculative type building, they're going to just design the two stories like we did here and just say build on them, and not until a whole bunch of people come to us. In the last year, we've had three families come to us, and the wives have gotten MS, and they've said, we got to sell our two-story house. We need a one-level house. We'd like to stay in the same community. We need this big a house, and we have to say, no, we can't build it for you because of this rule. That is the 35% lot coverage. This has happened to us three times in the city of Tualatin in the past year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Beck.
The impervious surface issue is, I guess, the one part of what I'd be concerned about. Endangered Species Act, the unknown territories of the Endangered Species Act restrictions that are going to come upon us, our own making or of federal imposition in the metro area. And I guess if we're, as we shrink the lot sizes, if we're going to increase the footprint of buildings, you could end up with subdivisions, new subdivisions, or add-ons to existing subdivisions where there's just no or very little dirt, grass, whatever. I guess I'd be concerned of neighborhoods that are just these kind of, you know, homes like this on small lots with with no shrubbery around them and no ground. I guess that's one concern I have off the top of my head. I guess the other concern I have is, I think we've all learned that good urban design is part of how we're going to get out of or create communities that work for us. It seems to me you're potentially impacting a local community's ability to influence or project some kind of good urban design into a neighborhood. And I think that's a worthy goal, to be able to have some design guidelines. Setbacks are a part of that, and maybe some footprint restrictions could be a part of that in some cases, maybe not in places. I think it would be short-sighted for us to take away a community's ability to set some parameters if they want to, if they feel they need to, for a whole bunch of reasons.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, with regard to your first point as to the impervious surface, that is a concern. But as with many of the bills we've talked about in this committee, you have competing concerns. And I think against that, I would put the interest of folks who don't want to aren't able to climb stairs, be able to have a home where they don't have to. And secondly, the issue of impervious surface as we increase density generally is a big deal. I think the movement, if we were to have this bill adopted, from two-story construction to one-story construction on a few lots around the area, is a fairly incremental issue compared to if you have a row house project that would have been single-family homes 20 years ago. There's a lot more impervious surface there on smaller land. So I think you make a good point. I'm not sure that this bill would have a huge impact on the impervious surface, though.
All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it very much. Next up will be Phil Fell, League of Oregon Cities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Philip Fell, here representing League of Oregon Cities and Stair Climbing Boomers. I would like to begin by noting that I appreciate the changes that have been suggested to 2883. I think it would make it a better bill. Sadly, I don't believe it makes it a tolerable bill. I think there are a couple of problems with it, and let me suggest that they would be these. From our perspective, if we were to make some changes like this, we would automatically trigger ballot measure 56 mailing requirements, which would mean we would have to mail everybody in a similar zone, run through public meetings, et cetera. The cost is, depending on whether it's in Duffer or Corvallis, is going to vary widely, but in some cities it's going to be a factor. Additionally, we are concerned about stormwater and coverage, and I think Mr. Chandler's right. You've got to weigh stuff off. But I think on the one hand, we are weighing off the changes proposed in the bill against potentially extraordinary taxpayer liability as we in the urban areas scramble to try to figure out how we deal with the declining species. And I think that's a risk that one falls directly on the taxpayers, and we would oppose that risk. And finally, let me point to in section 2, sub 2, which discusses the buildable land survey. And I appreciate what the proponents are trying to do with this, but essentially what it requires is we must, currently when we do buildable land supplies inventories, we do them by looking generally at the acreage that's available, and then depending on your city, they do some fairly sophisticated analysis that costs quite a bit of money. We're worried that we just might not be able to I'm having another 50s moment.
Never underestimate the power of a good night's sleep.
If only you would allow us, Mr. Chair.
Point taken and appreciated.
The stormwater requirements could be quite extraordinary simply because no one knows what's in stormwater to treat. It's whatever happened to run off a car in the parking lot or someone have to dump out of their car. Depending on how we deal with the Endangered Species Act, we may need to take some major stormwater reduction actions, which this bill, I think, would prohibit. The buildable land inventory. By having to divide 5 acres that we identify as available, if it's in the middle of a flat lot on the east side of Portland, there's not a lot of problem with identifying the particular acreage. But let's say that, in fact, as development is forced more to the hills and away from farmlands and more into just plain more difficult land to build on, that as that happens, we aren't sure that we are going to be able to do a very accurate buildable land supply if we have to divide some complicated acreage and say this amount can be covered and this amount can't. And then the question is, well, what's our liability on that? And I see we're trying to tie it here to the amount of buildable land contained in the general inventory, and would suspect that there is some penalty for disobeying that. And finally, you all know how complicated the land use system is. Certainly at the local government level, we get it. The legislature says something, LCDC says something, one half of a neighborhood says something, and the other half of a different neighborhood says something. And we are expected to make that work with everyone happy. I think this takes away a potential tool to enable us to meet some state density requirements and some regional density requirements that we may need. I don't know that every community will, and I can't predict which one will, but it's a tool that we need just to try to comply with the differing directions we're getting from you all. So I would encourage the committee to vote now. I'll try to answer any questions.
Thanks, sir. Any questions? All right, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2883. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 2463, and Representative Schrader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. With the chair's permission, I'll kind of walk the committee through the amendments. Would that be all right?
Sure. And before you do that, Representative, yes. I'd just like to remind everybody who happens to be here for hearings today, we've got a number of things on our list to complete. We want to try to be out of here by 4 o'clock today, so we just appreciate brevity on all parts.
Thank you, Chair. I'm leaving at 3:30.
Pardon me?
I'm leaving at 3:30. I got to
go. Okay. Did you say 4?
That's what I was aiming for.
You may be here by yourself.
Did you want 5?
Okay. Representative Schrader, sorry for the interruption. We'll get going.
Thank you. Hopefully the members have dash two amendments to the bill. As you recollect from a couple of weeks ago, I believe, your committee saw this bill. We indicated at that time that we didn't like how it came out of LC. We're going to form a work group. We did so. We had at least two of the citizens that were interested in the bill in the work group. We had League of Oregon Cities, Associated Oregon Counties, Metro, and then we had input from DLCD on this. The bill basically talks about getting rid of the original 3-mile prohibition. This was an old statute predating land use planning, quite frankly, that said that a city could not be formed within 3 miles of another city if that original city objected. And since that time, we've had land use planning, we've had, I think, a lot of great laws come into being, and we're now at a point, unfortunately, where that original law may be working against us. And by forcing only existing cities to expand to accept the increasing population, we've gotten into a problem where we're sprawling now over some of the best farmland in the country, and in our valley in particular here in the Willamette Valley area. So this bill is an attempt to, quite frankly, bring the land use planning process forward with where I think it has to be, and that's to allow certain areas to incorporate should they meet certain very, very high standards. The amendments, the dash two amendments, basically wipe out section one of the original bill, not necessary. It preserves all of Section 2 that you have. Section 2 basically is existing law, but it deletes subsection 4, which gets rid of the 3-mile prohibition. The reason that's important is the way Section 4 was written, a group of citizens in an area could not even begin to investigate incorporation because the city would have to give up its objection at the early stage of the process. So we kind of had a cart before the horse situation. One community in my district, Beaver Creek, wanted to say, well, now let's see if we want to incorporate. Let's see if that makes sense. Well, they couldn't begin to do that because the way the statute's currently written, the city would have to object or give up its objection right. And the city that they were next to said, well, I'm not necessarily against Beaver Creek incorporating, but I'd kind of like to see how big they're going to be, what services they can provide, all that sort of thing. Beaver Creek says, well, we can't tell you that information because we have to be able to go forward to begin with, which means you have to give up that right to object. So we had a real conundrum there, a catch-22 the cities can work with. So if you look at your Dash 2 amendments, what that does basically is line out a process other than what's currently in that subsection 4. It defines neighboring city, talks about the urban reserve areas, which we already have in statute, and it defines rural unincorporated communities. And our work group said, well, geez, we just don't want cities springing up all over, some little lonely subdivision out in the middle of nowhere can all of a sudden decide it wants to become a city. This is a very high standard. Only those areas within an urban reserve area or that are part of an existing rural unincorporated community, in other words, already a recognized community, if you will, on all land use maps by LCDC and by the counties, can go for this. So we have kind of a discrete entity. This does not open up the land use process, I think, in a way that many of us would be very concerned about. So we define that very, very clearly. And then on page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments, I think it gets at that. It talks about the area proposed to be incorporated must be located entirely within an urban reserve area or include a designated rural unincorporated community. Then it talks about in B that the affidavit, if you're going to go this route, you have to have at least 10% of the owners in the area favoring the incorporation. The petitioners must have already talked to the neighboring cities, talking about the boundaries, how things would be worked out, what sort of space would be between the cities if that's their inclination or not. And allow for growth of those cities. If, Happy Valley needs to expand, that would be part of the discussion they'd have with a group of citizens nearby to allow them the opportunity to reclaim and have some increased urban reserve lands. And then if they meet those two initial conditions, then they go ahead with this feasibility study. In other words, they get a chance to at least look at this and see if they agree that this is a good idea. And if you'd notice on page 2, sub C, A, it says this economic feasibility must include indication that this proposed city can provide or shall provide a cost-effective minimum level of urban services. In other words, they have to be able, within the city boundaries, to provide water, sanitary and stormwater sewers and streets, and that they have to demonstrate a permanent rate limit that's going to accomplish that fact. So the citizens that are looking at this have a very clear idea of what they're getting into. And C and D in that section are real important. We had a lot of feedback from Metro, DLCD, counties, and cities that, hey, is this a way to allow for low-density development cities to occur and get around our land use planning process? The answer is no. If you look at C, it says the urban growth boundary for the proposed city cannot be greater than the urban growth boundary of the neighboring city, and that's to protect the cities from having a huge Beaverton build outside of it. It's a small town to begin with. But D says, requires the proposed city to plan for amount of density and development that is not less than that was designated in the urban reserve area. And then the second sentence says, the proposed city, if it's not in an urban reserve area, like say it's down in southern Oregon, outside of Grants Pass or something, that if it's not in an urban reserve area, that proposed city has to have the density and development comparable to the neighboring city. In other words, folks, this is a really good piece of legislation. It encourages good land use planning.
You do say so yourself.
Yes, that's what that means, isn't it?
On the bottom of page 2, sub 3 talks about, okay, well, what's the process? I mean, say they go through all these hoops in the neighboring city, Grants Pass says, oh, man, this is crazy. I just don't want these people doing it. I've got all sorts of other big reasons. It's just a dumb idea. What this does is says, okay, well, I understand there may be some concerns, and we talked about this, the cities and the counties in our work group. And they said, well, let's go to the county commissioners. That's county court meets commissioners. For those of you, it's not a legal thing. This is the commissioners. And so what happens is the proposed city people make their case before the county commissioners. The existing city makes their case. And the word, I think the terminology in there is adversely affects the existing city. So it's a pretty high standard. And I think, quite frankly, that it'd be very tough for a new group of citizens who want to start a city to be able to prevail in a situation where the case is very straightforward, that that's not a good idea, not economic for the county, not economic for the existing neighboring city. And then the Section 4 goes into a little more detail, and Section 4 and 5 go into a little more detail about how that proceeding would work. So what you have is kind of an arbitration process in place that allows the city and the new proposed city to kind of work this out, go through the process, I think, in a fair and equitable manner that doesn't bypass the citizens' opportunity for a little self-determination. So that's, in a nutshell, run through. Sorry to take so much time. It's a big issue. And I think this is an attempt to kind of, as I said, bring the land use planning process forward, allow a little local self-determination, prevent sprawl. Little bill, but could have big impacts, I think big positive impacts. So that, I'm open to questions.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as to why on page 3, or on the bottom of page 2 and the start of page 3, that it's the county commissioners that are put in a position of making a position rather than LCDC or someone else who actually makes decisions about land use decisions. I guess my concern is that you're putting county commissioners in a very awkward spot. I mean, if you've got, you know, they can't win regardless of what decision that they would make, because you've got some people that want to create a new city, you've got the other people who don't, and then you're making the county commission the court of deciding whether or not that makes sense.
That's very, Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, that's a very fair comment. And the work group, we worked on this, the counties didn't seem to have a problem with it, quite frankly. I believe it was their suggestion or a compromise that we came to. And I'd reference you to sub 5 on page 3. They are not the final determiner. It does go to LUMA. And this group, as you well know, is the final arbiter in all land use proceedings. It does, and I think that's very appropriate. Your comment's very correct, and that's where we end up. This was an attempt, if it was a no-brainer, that we could get it done quick and easy and early, not have to go through any extensive process. But you're right, LUMA is the final arbiter.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that.
Representative
Starr. Local governments decide land use decisions all the time, from cities to counties, and this is just another kind of a land use decision. And as a former city councilor, every time you have to make one of those decisions, you have people that like it and people that don't. Mm-hmm. And so I would just say that county commissions are generally used to making those kinds of decisions.
I would, if I may, Mr. Chair, I think cities are probably more used to making land use decisions than county commissions are.
I would just add that my county commissioners are in hot water all the time anyway, so this would just be another day.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Starr.
I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2463.
Representative Starr has moved the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2463. Is there any discussion?
I have another question to the representative for us, if I may.
What? Go ahead, that's fine.
So suppose we have a scenario, let's say, in Hillsborough. We've got people inside Hillsborough, and they're next to an urban reserve area that hasn't developed yet. And the city intends to go there someday, but isn't ready, and they have plans for open space, other public facilities they want to see happen there. But they're not ready, and they want to go out there maybe 10, 20 years from now, and people who live in the adjacent neighborhoods kind of rely on, at least while they own their houses, sort of being there next to a farm area or rural area. And but the five landowners who own the property in that area, they'd like to do it now. They'd like to develop now. They aren't interested in the city's designs or plans or visions, and so they, under this bill, they get the, they go elect some county commissioners who are friendly to them, three or five, however many, you know, is often done in rural communities, and they incorporate and have a, they get zoning that's very intensive development with none of the goal, none of meets none of the adjacent city's goals, okay, along scenario. How would you, and then the people who are left behind in Hillsboro are upset with the future. I'm sorry, gentlemen.
This is a question.
This is a question. Sorry.
Talking about
I'm trying to paint a picture here, and if it, you know, doesn't meet your sensibilities, I'm, you know, tough baloney.
Not presented back.
That's a good question.
I guess a Republican phrase represented.
Thank you. How can the city then, I mean, it seems to me that in that scenario, the people who are left behind are, none of the city's ultimate goals are met.
Right.
You create a type of community that's incompatible with the adjacent community. You're doing, maybe developing something more quickly than the city had intended. The people who are left behind are unhappy.
Let me, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to try and answer that. Raise a good question, and that's certainly the reason this bill, I think, is crafted the way it is, to avoid as much as humanly possible that happening. I'd point out that currently one of the big problems that I saw in my 16 years on the Planning Commission was that you'll have a few landowners trying to annex a little bit, and then you get these little pods or peninsulas of growth occurring and kind of stringing out the land use process, which accidentally would force adjacent neighbors to do something they did not want to do. You'd have a few ruling the many. And you ended up with probably not very good land use plan because you've got all these little tiny, you know, developments coming out rather than a very good broad swath of, hey, let's plan an area out and do what we really need for good land use planning. So the idea of the bill here is to provide a little bit of the flexibility that I think, you know, we're trying to get in the statutes. I point to, there's several key points in this statute that would catch that sort of thing from happening, of people trying to overwhelm others and not allowing the existing city to do what it needs to do. I look on page 2, line 10. Basically, it talks about the petitioners have engaged. It's the first step. Must have engaged. The petition they put in must show that they have engaged in neighboring cities in discussions concerning all the effects you just pointed out. Admittedly, that's a very informal process, but I would hope that we'd start out at least at that level. And then the petition itself shows that they can't, you know, I don't think Five Guys could form. There's no way if Five Guys could do an economic feasibility study and provide the urban level of services that are actually required. You'll notice the words in there says shall require a minimum level of service. So that was done on purpose to avoid this, well, yeah, maybe the original bill, the original amendments I had said capable of. And those could be misconstrued later on where a person could say, yeah, capable of, and then when it came down to do it, did something entirely differently. They also, I point you to D here that says they can't do something different than neighboring city. There has to be a density and development that is comparable to the neighboring cities. That takes care, I think, of your concern that they're totally bagging the vision of the pre-existing city. It has to be something comparable. And I think the county court, the county commissioners that would frankly be looking at this would have to take all these things into account. Certainly LUBA would on the final analysis and be able to state very clearly, hey, we've either taken all these things into consideration. Either if you have, it's a go. If you haven't, then I'm sorry, we're not going to allow you to incorporate.
Follow up. A quick question.
Go ahead.
What if the adjacent city's goal for a large portion of that land was to acquire it for open space?
Excellent question. I'd like to respond, Mr. Chair. Actually, that's my goal for introducing this bill. I don't want to see all these communities, whether it's Sandy and Gresham, whether it's Beaver Creek and Oregon City, or some other town and some other part of the state grow together. I see this as an opportunity to have a discrete urban area with a rural reserve, if you're in the metropolitan Portland area, between it and the next city. I think that's how you do it without having to buy all the parkland, which many cities can't afford to do. I see this as an opportunity to have discrete communities with livable space around them that doesn't burden the taxpayer and allows our farms to continue to operate. So I think it's an excellent vehicle, and I've already seen several cities, my district, Sandy, doing this right now with Gresham, Oregon City, and Wilsonville.
One final question for our red-shirted representative.
Representative Beck.
Totally unintentional, if I may say so.
Well, I think there's a goal here. Would this have allowed Rajneesh Param to have incorporated?
I'm not familiar with Rajneesh Param's whole venue. I can't answer that.
All right. Thank you. We've got a motion currently on the floor that the Dash 2 amendments be moved into House Bill 2463. Representative Starr made that motion. Is there any further discussion? Any objections?
I won't object to evidence.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
Move House Bill 2463 as amended to the floor with a few pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves House Bill 2463 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
Aye.
Decker?
Aye.
Harper? Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries. And the carrier will be Representative Schrader.
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2463. Let me ask the committee, I've heard some stories about various timetables going on today. People have some critical deadlines. What?
3:30 in this room with the rules.
Yeah. Is it? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right, and who else is operating under a deadline here?
I can stretch it out till about 2:45, but I'm supposed to be at the coast before 5 o'clock.
Okay. Representative Bowman, are you?
And Mr. Chair, I just have to testify on a bill that will be coming up next door, but I did expect we'd be out by 3:15, so I do have two meetings scheduled back-to-back after
that. Okay, good enough. Let me think just for a moment here. Let me look at my schedule. Hmm? Yeah.
I got a golf game. I got a golf game for...
You had a golf game?
No.
Oh, I was going to say, excuse me.
I got a research charter going up to lay an undersea cable that I'm supposed to be down there on 4-5.
Okay.
You go that way? No.
Okay, we're going to
carry some paperwork before they leave.
Open a work session on House Bill 2976. And Representative Atkinson, as long as you are next to me, I'll let you operate off that script, if you will. This is for the purpose of moving a bill to another committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2976 to the floor without recommendation that be referred to the Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs.
Representative Atkinson has moved House Bill 2976 to the floor without recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Representative,
this is sounding more and more like radio all the time in front of this committee. I'm going to object to it.
All right. If no further objections, the motion carries. All right, thank you. I think in the limited time that we have left, I think we'll open a work session on House Bill 2657. And Mr. Chancellor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Criminal Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2657. I will do my best to be very brief, understanding the schedule everybody's under. This is the bill we had a hearing that got fairly lively about a month and a half or so ago. It deals with construction excise taxes. The original bill prohibited construction excise taxes with the exception of those which looked like system development charges. The Dash 2 amendments in front of you do several things. The first thing they do is they grandfather in the two jurisdictions in the state that currently have construction excise taxes in place. That's the city of Canby and the city of Fairview. The second thing they do is they do not attempt to tie to allow construction excise taxes under any certain set of circumstances. The first bill, the original bill, said you could have them if they looked like an SDC and went to infrastructure. What we ran into in dealing with legislative counsel is that was simply too complicated to draft in such a way that we didn't open up the SDC statutes to an entirely new beast, construction excise tax SDCs, that did not have the methodology requirement, didn't have the same restrictions that SDCs do. As a result, what you have in front of you in the Dash 2 amendments is simply a prohibition on construction excise taxes. And the reason for that, again, as I discussed earlier, is very simple. We have believe that local government should charge those taxes that apply to the entity being taxed. If construction excise tax simply goes in the general fund, should not be encouraged. We are protecting those cities which already have them, and we would encourage you to help us stave off those that do not have them. We're glad to take any questions, Mr. Chairman, if that's appropriate. Otherwise, I would encourage your support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2657.
Thank you. Let me ask you committee, any thoughts on this? Any particular discussion here?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, yes.
I'd move the dash two amendments if you'd like me to in House Bill 2657.
Let me delay that just for a moment, just to ask if any of you have any particular thoughts, inclinations about any questions about the construction excise tax?
No question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chandler knows that I will not be supporting this because I don't believe that we should be prohibiting local governments from addressing the needs that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether we move it today or next week, mm-hmm. I will be in the same position.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I'll vote for this one. I looked at it for a while and made my mind, and so if it's any help.
All right. Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? All right. Representative Starr has moved the dash two amendments into House Bill 2657. And Representative Atkinson, if we could call you up here for a vote, please. Appreciate that. Representative, just to catch you up here, Representative Starr has moved the dash two amendments into House Bill 2657. All right, is there any discussion? Right, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Is it amendment?
Yes. Yeah.
Aye.
Bowman?
No.
Deckard? Harper? Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. And the dash two amendments are carried.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Starr.
I move that House Bill 2657 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves House Bill 2657 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
No.
Jeffords? Harper? Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye. House Bill 2657 is adopted, and we will have Representative Lewis carry her on that.
Okay.
Yes. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2657. I think that at this point in time, we've done a lot of work today, and we're going to be in and out. This place has been kind of like an anthill today. And so I think what we'll do is we will pull the remaining bills on our schedule off and reschedule them for Tuesday. All right.
I was hoping to get to that one good Chandler bill that's on here.
Yeah.
You want to vote? Or maybe we should vote on that one now.
Mr. Chairman? I believe that we will not check.